This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming to the first lecture of the fall series of the Mini Medical School. My name is Daria Motamedi. I'm one of the assistant professors of clinical radiology here at UCSF. My specialization is orthopedic imaging or musculoskeletal imaging, and I will be speaking to you today about imaging common sports-related injuries. My colleague, Tara Morgan, will be speaking next on musculoskeletal ultrasound. And without further ado, my goal is to make this as close to a medical school experience as possible. So there's going to be a lot of imaging, a lot of material to get through, and we'll do the best we can. And by the end of this lecture, there are three questions that I want you to be able to answer without a second thought, and I'll present to you the questions here. First, question one being this image. This is, I will tell you, of the knee, and the question being, what plane of imaging is shown here? This is an MRI of the knee. And again, what plane of imaging is shown here? The options being a sagittal MRI plane, a coronal MRI plane, an axial plane, or none of the above. Second question, again, an MRI, again, of the knee. Now you can see the appearance of this image is quite different. The question in this case is, what type of MRI is being shown here? A T1, a T2, a T1 with fat suppression, or a T2 with fat suppression. And while at first I think some of these terms may be foreign, by the end of this lecture my hope is that you will really be able to answer these quite confidently. The last question, again, a MR image of the knee, and which injury is depicted here, and we'll go through this as well. So in terms of our overview, we're going to start with a protocol, how any radiologist would look at a knee and what sequences we would obtain. Next, we'll go through some basic anatomy of the knee and a search pattern that a radiologist would use. Next, we'll look at the ligaments in and around the knee. This will include the anterior cruciate ligament, the posterior cruciate ligament, in addition to the medial and lateral supporting structures. We'll discuss the meniscus. The meniscus is a frequently injured structure, and you hear about it in the media, on sports channels quite often. As patients age, they'll also develop the degenerative meniscal tear, so I want to go through that and so that you have an experience with meniscal tears, the different types of meniscal tears, what they look like, and what the treatment options are for the different types of meniscal tears. Next, we'll discuss the extensor mechanism of the knee, which includes the quadriceps tendon and the patellar tendon. Then we'll talk about cartilage, and finally finish off with a few miscellaneous items. So starting with our protocol, this is a sagittal MRI sequence of the knee. And we'll go through kind of what is a sagittal and what is a coronal and what is an axial. But just to go through these one by one, we started with a sagittal T2. This is now a sagittal T1. We also do a coronal T1 and a coronal T2. A sagittal image will be a image through the side of the knee, as seen here. A coronal image will be cutting superior to inferior through the knee and kind of having a frontal projection, much like we see with radiographs of the knee. We'll do that as well in the coronal T1 and T2 fat suppressed plane. And then we do a single axial, which is a transverse image through the knee. And we do this T2 fat suppressed as well. You can identify this as a fat suppressed image because all of the subcutaneous fat is dark. So a T2 will show fluid to be bright, whereas a T1 will show fat to be bright. So this is a sagittal T1. And as you can see here, the fat is bright now. So the main difference between T1 and T2 is T1 is going to show fat bright and T2 is going to show fluid bright. And that's really all you need to know for the purposes of reading MRI of the knee. In terms of the anatomy and our search pattern, we're going to start with the sagittal sequences and what we see best on sagittal sequences. This includes the ligaments, the ACL and the PCL, the posterolateral corner structures, as well as the medial and lateral meniscus, as well as the meniscal roots. We'll look for the patellofemoral extensor mechanism. You can see here the distal quadriceps tendon, as well as the patellar tendon. There is also a patellar aponeurosis, which runs anterior to the patella itself, as well as bursa in the soft tissues anteriorly. Next, we'll discuss the bones and the cartilage. So looking at an MRI, and we're starting lateral here, the way we know that we're lateral on a sagittal MRI is because we see the fibula. And if you feel your own knees, you know that you can feel a bony prominence at the lateral aspect of the knee. This is your proximal fibula or your fibular head. And that is what we're imaging right here. There are certain structures which attach here, but we'll see them better on coronal sequencing, and so we'll wait to discuss those specifically. In terms of what we see then, as we start imaging from lateral now to medial through the knee, we begin with a bow tie type appearance structure, which is low signal on all sequences. This is the medial meniscus. This is the lateral meniscus, excuse me. And there will be an anterior horn to the meniscus, a body to the meniscus, and a posterior horn to the meniscus. So if you're reading a radiology report, they'll often describe where the tear exactly is. As we continue medially, we'll get to these ligamentous structures that we always evaluate on MRI of the knee. First, the anterior cruciate ligament. Remember that this structure is providing most of the anterior stability of the knee. Much of the physical examination testing the anterior cruciate ligament will be applying stress to the tibia and trying to deviate it anteriorly to demonstrate on clinical exam a deficient ACL. Much in a similar way, deficient PCL would allow more posterior translation of the knee than expected. The anterior cruciate ligament is this low signal structure on all sequences on sagittal imaging. You can see it has a femoral attachment and a tibial attachment. The PCL is right behind the ACL, and this structure is going to provide most of the posterior stability, again, to the knee. As we come to the medial side of the knee now, we again see the medial meniscus. The shape and structure of the medial meniscus is exactly the same as the lateral meniscus. You can see, again, there's an anterior horn, a body, and a posterior horn. And we skipped over a couple things that I want to go back and talk about, specifically the quadriceps tendon and the patellar tendon. We ask our residents how many contributions are there to a quadriceps tendon, and almost always they quickly put two and two together and understand that it starts with quad, and so they say four. But just be aware, a lot of these things, these structures are named based on how many of these tendinous slips are coming in. So with the quadriceps tendon, you may see some abnormal signal at its distal aspect, and this can just be a normal conglomeration of these four tendons and not necessarily intersubstance tearing, tendinosis, or something like that that we would describe with other tendons that are just a singular tendon. The patellar tendon is this tendon. It's connecting the patella to the tibial tuberosity. This becomes important in cases of patellar tendon tears, obviously, but also in adolescents who have pain at the tibial tuberosity, as you can have a traction apophysitis right at the tibial tubercle, especially in jumping athletes, basketball players, volleyball players, and they'll have pain focally right at that patellar tendon insertion. The patellar tendon is also going to be important surgically when we do ACL reconstructions. That is the most commonly used bone-tendon-bone transfer to recreate an ACL that's now torn and deficient. So first, we've discussed sagittal MRI imaging, what we look for on sagittal MRI, what makes this a sagittal sequence. And again, if I asked you, is this a T1 or a T2 weighted image, you would answer that this is a T2 weighted image because the fluid is bright on this sequence. T1, again, will have fat being bright, and we can see here that all of the fat is dark, and this would then be a T2 fat-suppressed image, a fluid-sensitive sequence with the fat suppressed. And this is our typical workhorse for imaging and sports-related images on the sagittal sequence. Moving on now to our coronal sequence. Remember, now we're imaging as if the patient's standing right in front of us and going up and down through the distal femur and proximal tibia from anterior now to posterior rather than from lateral to medial. And we're going to see different structures better on this sequence than we did on sagittal. Most obviously will be the medial and lateral supporting structures. So the MCL, as denoted here, the medial collateral ligament, will be better seen on coronal, as will the lateral collateral ligament. There are certain other structures as part of our lateral collateral ligament complex that will include not only the lateral collateral ligament, but also the iliotibial band, as well as the biceps femoris tendon. You may hear of entities called like runner's knee or iliotibial band friction syndrome, and we'll discuss that in more detail. But basically, runners are more prone to thickening of this lateral iliotibial band, which lies just superficial to this lateral collateral ligament. And sometimes some of the soft tissue structures and fat in between that distal iliotibial band and the lateral femoral condyle will become inflamed. And this is something that's treated conservatively just with rest, and nothing really beyond that is required. You can see that we get a second view also of the meniscus, right? So here's, again, the medial meniscus, now visualized from anterior to posterior rather than from lateral to medial. We also get a nice view of the lateral meniscus, again, from anterior to posterior. What we may see better are the root attachments of the meniscus, too, as they dive deep into the bone, which we don't really get as well on the sagittal sequences. We also see the bones quite nicely here. This is the distal femur. We can see the lateral femoral condyle, the medial femoral condyle. This is proximal tibia, so we can see the tibial plateaus both laterally and medially. Again, we know this is lateral because we can see the proximal fibula. And you can also see that there's a proximal tibiofibular joint. So just to be aware, you'll hear people reference the knee joint. There is no such thing as a knee joint, right? Because if we look at a knee, there are several joints involved in the knee. So we will discuss a medial femoral tibial compartment, a lateral femoral tibial compartment or joint, and a patellofemoral compartment or joint. So there are, in fact, three joints within a knee joint. And the last thing that we'll see is cartilage. The cartilage is the buffer between the bone and the menisci, and we'll see that better on MR imaging. You can see that we could also see the distal quadriceps tendon and patellar tendon, as well as the patella itself, quite nicely on these coronal sequences as well. And so we're going to now go from anterior to posterior through the knee in coronal sequences. This is, again, I'll tell you, going to be a T2 fat-suppressed sequence. And so as we go, we know we're anterior. How? Because we're seeing the patella. And so from the patella, we course backwards. We can definitely see the distal quadriceps tendon. If there was a tear or tendinosis of that, we'd be able to identify that. Same goes for the patellar tendon. And now as we cut posteriorly, we get towards some of these ligamentous structures, the most anterior of which is going to be our iliotibial band. Okay, so this most anterior lateral structure, this black line that we're seeing, is the iliotibial band. And as we proceed posteriorly, we get to see more lateral structure. So we'll stay on the lateral side for now. This is the lateral collateral ligament. Sometimes you'll hear it as the fibular collateral ligament. And as we can proceed even farther posteriorly, we get to the proximal fibula, and you can see these tendinous attachments on the proximal fibula. Okay? Going back to the medial structures, this is much more simple. There's really just one main structure on the medial side, superficial and deep fibers of the medial collateral ligament, or the MCL. And as you can see here, it looks very similar. It's a low signal structure on all sequences. And we'll describe this as abnormal if there's fluid signal around it or frank discontinuity of the ligament itself. And I'll have cases of that for you later. In terms of the bones, you can see how nicely we would see the bones, the distal femur, the proximal tibia. If there were any abnormality of the bone, let's say a bone tumor, a fracture, a bone infarction, or anything like that, we would see it quite nicely on this type of a sequence. And lastly, the cartilage. So the cartilage is going to be the gray structure between the bone and the meniscus. So all of this gray signal is cartilage. And as you can see, we don't really see the cartilage so well. We can see it in some of the newer techniques, 3-Tesla, MR imaging is great for this, and we have become quite good at this, but we're still not where we want to be. And I think that's why there's so much research still in 7T MR and so on and so forth to get better cartilage imaging. We've also developed here, Thomas Link in our section has done a lot of cartilage research, and Ben Ma, one of our sports surgeons, has come up with cartilage mapping. So we can get really specific data on cartilage, which we don't even see at the time of the MRI, but certain post-processing algorithms and softwares allow us to really go back and evaluate the cartilage and tell our patients if they do, in fact, have any cartilage loss that maybe is so early that it's not even seen at the time of the MRI. Now, why would we do this? Who cares? The reason is that once cartilage is gone, it's gone, and we can't get it back. You may have heard of microfracture surgeries, autologous chondral implants, or even chondrocyte implantation into joints. I know a lot of basketball players these days are getting microfracture surgery from a Greg Oden to an Amari Stoudemire, and these are temporizing or temporary procedures. They'll allow the patient to go back, play for a few more years, but at that point, the cartilage wears away again, and they need a repeat procedure, be it a repeat microfracture, or if they're done playing, perhaps a total knee if the cartilage damage is so bad. So that's why there's so much focus now on cartilage research, and preserving as much cartilage as we can. Next, most important will become the meniscus then, because the meniscus is providing most of the hoop stress to the knee. It's every time we step, every time we run, we're putting a lot of stress on our knees, and what's buffering that is the meniscus. So oftentimes, once the meniscus is torn, it's no longer offering those hoop stresses, it's no longer serving as the buffer between the two bones, and then the cartilage takes the brunt of the damage. Once the cartilage is gone, then the bones take the brunt of the damage, and those then are then prone to stress fracture, and so on. So it's kind of a vicious cycle once it starts, and then it progresses to a total knee arthroplasty. And at that point, you've now treated the problem. So moving on now from coronal to an axial, we're now discussing a transverse section, right, through the knee. And we're going to start from proximal and go distally, so about the distal femur all the way to the proximal tibia. And a compartment that we really haven't talked anything about is best seen on this sequence, which is the patellofemoral joint. So we've described the femoral tibial compartments, both medial and lateral, but we haven't really talked about the patellofemoral. We'll see that on the MR. You can also get a second look at the MCL and the lateral collateral ligament, lateral supporting structures. You may see the meniscus if you're lucky. Sometimes the cuts on an axial sequence don't include the meniscus perfectly, so we use that when we can. And you may also see soft tissue abnormalities, be it fluid collections, bodies in the joint, things like that, muscle strains. So if we look at just a schematic representation, this is what we would expect to see. You can see that we can identify the ACL on transverse section. We can also identify the PCL, but I think they were much more obvious on those sagittal sequences. You're just getting one cut through them in this plane, whereas they're really in long axis on the sagittal plane, and even at some points on a coronal plane. You can identify the fat, subcutaneous, and then this being the lateral condyle and so on and so forth. And then remember that there are bursa in the soft tissues around the knee. There's more than just the prepatellar. You also have a superior patellar, infrapatellar, and a deep infrapatellar. So there are at least four. Some will also include a pes anserine bursa, which is anterior, medial, and inferior. So many bursa in and around the knee also that could become inflamed. And the reason I bring that up is if you ever have kind of a someone with a kind of fluctuant mass that, you know, is soft, it doesn't really seem like a hard mass or a soft tissue mass, and it may be filled with fluid, perhaps someone who's working on their knees a lot, a carpet layer or someone like that, that would be someone who could develop a prepatellar bursitis. And the bursa will just fill up with fluid whenever it's inflamed, okay? So it can be something like repetitive microtrauma, as in that case, but it could also be something like infection. It could be a crystal deposition disease like a gout, and so on and so forth. Very nonspecific as far as imaging is concerned. So without further ado, let's talk about this patellofemoral joint. This is the patella. This is the femur. This then is the patellofemoral joint. And what we look for here is this is really the same thing. Here's the cartilage. Here's the bone. And here's more bone. And so we are really just looking for any joint space narrowing, anything that would suggest degenerative change, as well as any pathologies that we may see. On occasion, you'll have a thickened plica, which can arise from either the medial or lateral aspect of the joint and insinuate into these areas of cartilage and cause full thickness chondral defects. And that's important to let the surgeon know about, because when they go in to do whatever else they're going to do in the knee, they'll often resect the plica at that time. And these can be clinically painful and maybe the only finding on an otherwise normal MRI. So moving on now from really the basics. So we've gone through sagittal, coronal, and now axial MR sequences through the knee. We've discussed together what we look for on each of those different sequences, what the basic anatomy of the knee looks like. And so having done that, we can now get really into the meat of this lecture, which is going to be abnormalities of the knee, okay? And remember, we're going to focus on sports-related injuries. So we'll start with the ACL. The ACL is again, remember, on our sagittal T2 sequence is going to connect from the proximal from the distal fibula to the proximal tibia. It should be continuous on all sequences. There should be no discontinuity or abnormal signal is really what we're looking for. And I want you to compare and contrast this sagittal image through the ACL with this second sagittal image through the ACL. You can quickly identify that this ACL, first of all, is not normal. It's not low in signal, and it's not continuous. There's a gap between the tendon fibers right here. Also, there's abnormal signal throughout the ACL. So there's increased T2 signal. And when we say increased T2, we mean fluid. So now there's edema, fluid, the body reacting to this torn ACL, perhaps even blood, right? And so this is what a torn ACL will look like on MR images. An ACL tear is very common. The incidence of acute rupture is about 1 in 3,000. It's immediately disabling. So the way that a patient will present is typically with a non-contact mechanism. They describe a dynamic valgus moment where the leg is lateral or valgus to the knee itself, and then some sort of twisting motion. And if you watch football, there have been a number of these types of injuries this year, Jamal Charles most recently. But this is a very common injury that you'll see in any busy musculoskeletal practice or orthopedic practice daily. And it's about 50 to 175,000 cases that are reconstructed just in the United States per year, making it the sixth most common procedure. And what they'll do is arthroscopic single bundle reconstruction for most of these, and that's what they do here routinely. So the mechanism of injury, again, as here, is going to be a dynamic valgus moment, frequently a non-contact mechanism, with a sudden change of direction or deceleration. This is one. Another mechanism is going to be a force which places the knee into this sort of a arrangement, right? So if we had a lineman roll into a quarterback as he's planted his leg, this would recreate this sort of an appearance, or at least apply a valgus stress to the knee. And this is why the NFL has outlawed clipping and other such mechanisms of injury, because of how commonly the ACL is injured when those sorts of forces are applied to the knee. Skiing is a little bit different. It's really more the sudden quadriceps contraction rather than a valgus moment that's going to be resulting in the ACL injury. So understand that skiers may be prone as well to ACL injuries, but the mechanism is going to be quite different. In terms of what we're describing there, it's more of a pivot shift as they're planting to kind of turn from one leg to another and apply, again, a valgus-type stress. So just to go over a couple of these, this is a couple of football players, Adrian Peterson and Tom Brady, and we'll just show you one example of what this looks like when a lineman does roll up into the knee or the leg of a quarterback as he's planting his non-dominant leg. And frequently you'll see someone kind of stop and plant and twist, and it's that motion on a planted foot that is going to result in the ACL-type tear. Dr. Andrews and some of the other prominent orthopedic surgeons who do a lot of sports medicine will talk about the importance of elevating the heel off the foot. So if you the heel off the ground. So if you are twisting, it is always better to have the heel up off the ground because you have a lower incidence of an ACL frank tear. You'd be more likely to sprain the ACL but still have a continuous ligament in that case, even if you did have a valgus moment. So it's a combination, really, of this turning motion, the valgus force, and then a foot plant on the ground. Some of these imaging findings we've already discussed, so I'll skip them. But here, I want to describe some of the secondary findings, right? So when we are looking at an MRI, we don't just look at the ACL, look and identify it as torn or not torn and move on. There are frequently multiple other signs, secondary signs, that we can look for that can make this a sure thing. We're not really kind of guessing ever because we have other secondary findings that confirm the diagnosis for us. Those are going to include bone bruises where the bone is now knocking against each other because of the valgus moment. I'll show you what that looks like in just a second. Perhaps a deepening of the bone where it's impacting each other. There may be fractures of the bone, and we'll go through each and every one of these. So first of all, when the tibia is translating anteriorly, just imagine this tibia migrating anteriorly, knocking against the fibula, the distal femur, and then coming back into place, right? Because the ACL is deficient. If that happens, this posterior aspect of the tibia will knock into what's called the condylopatellar sulcus of this distal femur, and that's going to result in this bone contusion pattern, sometimes even an impaction fracture. Now, in addition to that, we'll also see edema at the posterior aspect of the tibia. So these are called kissing contusions and are quite pathognomonic for an ACL tear. Even if the ACL fibers aren't necessarily discontinuous, perhaps you have some artifact, you're not able to see the tendon so well, this would be a very strong secondary sign, as would a very large knee joint effusion, an injury that was described as immediately disabling. The patients will say that their knee swells up to the size of a basketball. It's not just a small effusion, as you may see with other sorts of injuries, such as meniscal tears and things like that. So it's acutely disabling and large effusion. Those are quite common presentations. When we have that impaction injury, sometimes it can result in this deepening of the femoral sulcus, as you can see here. And then all of this increased T2 signal under that is, again, fluid. It's now not in the soft tissues. It's in the bone. The bone has been hit by another bone. It doesn't like that, so it manifests with quite a bit of fluid. And if you're ever wondering why athletes, let's say professional athletes who have an injury, don't go for an MRI that night. Very often they injure themselves Friday and they wait till Monday morning to do the MRI. It's not because they can't get in for the MRI. It's really you want to give a couple days to the bones to manifest some of these reactive changes, right? So if we didn't have a lot of these reactive secondary changes like the effusion, like the bone marrow edema, it would make calling the ACL tear much harder. So that is, in fact, a reason you want to delay imaging by maybe at least up to 24 hours. In terms of other secondary signs, a fracture here off the lateral tibial plateau is called a Sagan fracture, and it's just very characteristic of someone with an ACL tear. You don't really see this fracture in other patients. So if we see this fracture, that also kind of heightens our awareness for an ACL tear. So let's switch gears now to a PCL tear. And if you think of just, you know, watching television or talking to friends and family, you hear about ACL tears all the time, ACL surgeries and this and that. PCLs, really, you don't hear much about. And there's a couple reasons for that. It's, first of all, much less frequent. And the mechanism would have to be quite interesting, right? So most of the time, to have such a direct force on the tibia that's going to translate the tibia posteriorly and result in tearing of the PCL is going to be something like an MVA. It really has to be the knee knocking against the dashboard under pretty significant force. So other than that, or perhaps a football player who's planted and has a direct force applied from anterior to posterior, the findings are going to be exactly the same. So everything we just described with the ACL, the discontinuity, the increased T2 signal, all of that's going to be the same, but now it's going to be in the distribution of the PCL, and instead of anterior translation of the tibia, we're going to see posterior translation of the tibia. And another reason you don't hear about this as much is that this is treated conservatively. So even a full tear of the PCL is most commonly going to be treated in adults with a brace. Okay, so they won't go in and do surgeries for isolated PCL tears in adults. In children, it's another issue, but in adults, that this will most often be treated conservatively with bracing. Here's an example of a PCL now, and you can see frank discontinuity of the PCL fibers. Here's our next video, and just to show you, it takes quite a jarring type of an injury to result in a PCL tear. This case was a running back who was moving forward, had a direct force applied to the knee, which translated the tibia posteriorly. But really short of an MVA or some sort of injury like this, I think it'd be quite rare for an isolated PCL tear. Next, we'll move on to the medial and lateral supporting structures. So the MCL is another one that you'll hear a lot about. So the MCL, we said, was this normal low-signal structure on the medial side of the knee. And you can see here what a normal MCL would look like and here what a frankly abnormal MCL would look like. It's no longer continuous with the tibia. It's altered in signal. So it's really not rocket science, right? Increased T2 signal, discontinuity of the fibers, really for any of these structures, ACL, PCL, MCL, LCL, it doesn't matter. They all look the same. The secondary findings are all varied and different, and so that takes a little more. But I think quickly, even just looking at an MRI, I'd want you guys to be able to look at it and say, you know, I think there's something wrong with that ACL because there's too much signal in it. The fibers may be discontinuous. And I think that is fairly easy to do, despite some of the secondary findings being more subtle. Okay, so how do we grade MCL injuries, and why does this become important? Grading the MCL injuries is done because the orthopedic surgeons do it. Okay, so to be honest, we'll grade it to either a mild strain, a partial tear, or a complete tear for our orthopedic surgeons. And this is because a grade 1 or 2 tear, they'll very often treat conservatively again with a brace of the knee and a limitation of activities. A grade 3 tear can be treated conservatively, but in very active individuals, in professional athletes, they will on occasion go in and operate on a completely torn MCL. So we do make that distinction. And just to show you what that means, here is an MCL, and we can see fluid, again, T2, this is now coronal, and we can see that there's fluid superficial to that MCL, and that's not normal. And so when we see that, especially in a case of medial-sided pain, joint line tenderness, this is consistent with a grade 1 or low-grade sprain of that MCL. Here's what a grade 2 injury would look like, and I wish the edema showed up a little better, but there's increased signal both superficial and deep now. So now some of the deeper fibers of the MCL are torn, and this would be a grade 2 injury. A grade 3 injury is called a grade 3 sprain, but really it's a frank tear of the MCL. You can see now there's some fibers, they're somewhat redundant, they're coiled back on themselves, and most of the medial collateral ligament you can't see at all. It's just blood and fluid and disorganized torn fibers. In terms of what may suggest that this happened chronically, perhaps someone was not even aware that they injured their MCL, but if they come in for an x-ray subsequently, this is now a coned down x-ray in the same plane, in that kind of coronal plane, the patient's facing us, and this is the medial aspect of the knee, and I coned down just to show you this fleck of bone. So this is just a tiny fleck of bone, and this is what a chronic MCL injury would look like. So if someone came in, you know, we would say perhaps there was some old MCL type of an injury based on this image, and a surgeon described it, so he applied his name to it, and we'll describe this as a Pellegrini striata lesion. You may see that in radiology reports or hear an orthopedic surgeon describe that. And all they mean is that there's some suggestion of an old MCL injury. And this is what it must have looked like acutely. Again, frank discontinuity, a lot of edema. And in this case, there was a direct impaction injury to the medial collateral ligament. And so the subjacent bone, the medial femoral condyle, is also manifesting with bone marrow edema, bone contusion. In terms of the lateral structures, we already kind of talked about this in the anatomy section, but we talked about the IT band as seen here. We said that some runners can develop iliotibial band friction syndrome, and this is what that would look like. It will be some right under the iliotibial band, some soft tissue edema interposed between that distal iliotibial band and the lateral femoral condyle. And this will manifest as pain, and again, the treatment will just be kind of limiting running and giving the knee some time to rest and recover. This is very frequently seen around now, marathon time with the Nike Women's Marathon and things like that. A lot of people coming in with lateral-sided pain, especially in runners, iliotibial band friction syndrome. In terms of other supporting structures that we look for laterally, we'll look for the fibulocollateral ligament. Otherwise, the lateral collateral ligament is another name for it. And you can see how this inserts on the femur here and inserts on the proximal fibula here. So we just look for that on every case. Should be low signal on all sequences. And you can see here, nothing. There's nothing low in signal that's linear that should be along this path. Instead, there's hemorrhage and disorganized, torn, low signal fibers. Biceps femoris tendon is another part of this lateral supporting structures, and so I won't belabor this point. It's another structure that we look for on the lateral side that also inserts on the proximal fibula. Because those structures on the lateral side mostly insert on the proximal fibula, injuries to the those structures may manifest as a bony avulsion fracture where the bone is ripped off by the tendon during an acute lateral-sided injury. And you can see I've provided you two sagittal. This is a T2 and this is a T1 MRI images demonstrating a avulsion fracture. But and I'll tell you, the fracture is right here, but how subtle a finding is that? So in a big mess of a knee with torn ligaments and a tiny, tiny avulsion fracture, this is to speak towards the importance of getting x-rays anytime we get an MRI. So a lot of people think, including some of our colleagues, that you know we've got an MRI, why would we ever need an x-ray? I think it's cases like this that show you really a tiny piece of bone can be easily missed on an MRI. especially with a very subtle finding such as this, that an X-ray would be just glaringly obvious for. So it's not this or that. Frequently we'll ask for an X-ray if it hasn't been done at the time of an MRI, because we do like to read them together, and I think it is best practice. Here's what that would look like now on the X-ray. Very obvious, a big piece of bone that shouldn't be there, consistent with an arcuate-type fracture. This is now moving on to the worst-case scenario in a knee. This is one of the Golden State Warriors players, Sean Livingston, back when he was with the Clippers, and he suffered a pretty drastic injury, which was a complete knee dislocation. You don't see these very often. When that happens, you have tears of the ACL, the PCL, the MCL, the LCL. I mean, you pick it. They're all gone, okay? And so then your next question might be, well, what's holding the knee together? And the answer is not much. Okay, so you can see here, this is not only rotated, the tibia is anteriorly translated. And in his case, he was lucky the tibia was translated, let's say, anteriorly. This isn't his case, but in this patient's case, that the tibia was translated anteriorly. If the tibia is translated posteriorly, there are some big vessels that run back there. The popliteal artery is back there, right? So you could transect the popliteal artery and bleed out and die. So this becomes a very serious injury then in terms of orthopedic and sports-related injury is probably the worst thing that we could see other than an infected knee joint. And so on imaging, we'll look at all the structures that we described. They'll all be abnormal. And this is something that the ACR, the American College of Radiology, likes to ask. Other than X-ray, when a patient comes in the emergency room and you're worried about a knee dislocation, what is the first study that you should get? And it's a little bit counterintuitive, otherwise they wouldn't ask it, right, on boards and things like that. And so the answer ends up being an MRI. But let me speak more about it, because that is quite counterintuitive. We just said that this person could have a life and death injury to the knee. And so we're relying on the clinical exam and the palpation of those pulses. If there's no palpable pulse of the popliteal artery, which is a very superficial, large artery, the patient should go immediately to surgery. Okay, and that's the teaching point of this question from the ACR. So frequently, I will tell you that people do go on to CT angiograms, and they do like to get a roadmap of the vessels before they go on to surgery, so that is still routinely done. But according to ACR, the right answer would be everything acutely treated based on the palpable pulses or non-palpable pulses, and then once they're stable, they can have an MRI to evaluate all the secondary injuries. So we've talked about the protocol, we've talked about what a T1 and T2 weighted MRI, we've talked about the different sequences, what a coronal sequence is, a sagittal sequence, an axial sequence. We've gone through some of the anatomy, the distal femur, the proximal tibia and fibula, the ligamentous structures, and now we're going to talk about the menisci. And we're going to spend the majority of the rest of this talk on the meniscus, because the meniscus is so frequently injured. You may be asked by friends or family or a neighbor, I got a radiology report, or my surgeon says that I have a torn meniscus, what do I do? And so my hope is to just go through different types of meniscus tears so that you'll be somewhat more expert at what exactly a meniscus tear is, and then what the different kinds are and what the different treatment options are for the different kinds. Okay, so first of all, what is a meniscus? We said that it was this bow tie low signal structure on all MRI sequences, right? This is a sagittal sequence. We have the anterior horn. This is anterior. The patella is right here. This is the body. And this is the posterior horn. So this is a normal appearance on MR imaging. And you can see this is a representation of an axial plane, right? So a transverse plane. So the meniscus, this is the anterior aspect of the meniscus, this is the body of the meniscus, and this is the posterior horn. But sagittal imaging is going to be imaging in this plane, right? Anterior to posterior. So we're going to be imaging this part of it, the anterior horn, the body, and the posterior horn. We flip that. That's what this looks like, right? So it's 90 degrees to each other, the schematic representation and the MR image. So as we go through, you can see the appearance starts to change, right? If you're in the outer section, it looks like this. But if you're in the inner section, now there's a gap in the middle, right? You're really only seeing the anterior horn and the posterior horn. So as we're sequencing from medial to lateral, we have to be aware of that anatomy and know what's normal and abnormal. So the normal is going to be this bow tie sign. And they say that there should be no more than 2 to 3 bow tie signs on a MRI. So that's just something to be aware of. In terms of a big or someone who may not have so many bow ties and that may be suggestive of an injury will be someone who's postoperative. Of course, if they've had part of their meniscus resected, they won't have as much meniscal tissue. Maybe they'll only have one or two bow ties rather than two or three. That makes sense. And then a congenitally small meniscus. So we just have to be aware of some of these pitfalls, but they are quite rare. And when they're postoperative, hopefully we know that. So again, here's an MR demonstrating the normal anterior horn, body, and posterior horn. This now is abnormal, right? And I think we can all kind of appreciate where this arrow is pointing, that the substance of this posterior horn of the meniscus now has abnormal increased signal within it. So now it looks like there's two pieces of the meniscus, okay? That's a meniscal tear. That's the easiest, frank meniscal tear without subcategorizing it. What our surgeons might see is something like this. So they're in arthroscopically now in the knee joint, and they see the meniscus. They might see a defect within the meniscus. And what they do is they routinely will go in for just run-of-the-mill meniscus tears and shave down that part of the meniscus, okay? This is a summary of what we're going to be talking about for about the next 5 to 10 minutes, and it's the types of meniscal tears, okay? So you can have longitudinal tears, which can be vertical, horizontal, or oblique, and I'll show you examples of that. That's going to be the most common type. So the most common types, let's say even up to 90% of meniscal tears, if you're not going to remember anything else, they're longitudinal, and they'll either be vertical or horizontal. The bucket handle and the radial tears are less common, but they're worse. Okay, so if you have a bucket handle type tear in a young person, that goes to surgery. If you have a radial tear, that often will go to surgery. So that's the distinction between the different types of tears. And I'll show you what each one of these look like. This is going to be, anytime you see something linear, that's going to be that longitudinal type tear. And you can see it could be short, it could be long. But when you have a piece of the meniscus that flips out now, this is what they describe as the bucket handle. This being the bucket, this being the handle. Okay, and the reason is every time someone would step, they would feel this piece of meniscus. And the flipped piece could be big, could be thin, but whatever it is, the person's going to feel it because it's not supposed to be there in the notch of the joint. And so they'll complain about clicking or catching or locking or just something that doesn't feel right in the joint. And frequently that's suggestive of this type of meniscal tear. With a radial tear, you can see instead of being longitudinal along the axis of the meniscus, it's going to be transverse. It's going into the substance of the meniscus from its free edge. So none of these are involving this C part, the free edge of the meniscus. If it involves that free edge, now we're dealing with a radial tear. These are typically more aggressively treated by the surgeons, and the reason for that is they're more prone to result in worse cartilage damage once torn. The reason is that most of the hoop stresses in a knee, in a meniscus, are propagating in the same orientation of a C. So if you think of a normal hoop, it's going to go like this, and like this, and like this, and so on. So if this is torn, you just have a small area of one hoop stress that's injured, right? So most of your cartilage-preserving capacity of a meniscus and weight-bearing capacity is preserved. In contrast, with a radial tear, we can see so many different hoop stresses all along this are now disturbed. So now that knee is going to be much more prone to early arthritis, early degenerative change, and so that's why our surgeons are more aggressive in treating those. Then you do have certain types where they call this a parrot beak tear because it looks like a parrot beak, and then you have this, which is a flap tear because you have a flap now of meniscal tissue, which is being displaced somewhere. The flap and the bucket handle are somewhat similar in that there's a piece of meniscus, shouldn't be where it is, and they're treated very quickly by our orthopedic colleagues because, again, they're seen in younger people and can result in early cartilage loss. So first case, this is a vertical tear, and you can see the plane on a sagittal MR is in the vertical orientation. It's linear, so it's longitudinal. So this would be a longitudinal vertical tear. And this would be something that you could see either in someone with an ACL tear, let's say this tibia translated anteriorly, the two pieces of the meniscus, this something would have to give. And so this meniscus might tear right here, and then the entire tibia is allowed to translate anteriorly. So that's one scenario. It may also be seen on a degenerative basis. So sometimes just wear and tear chronically will result in degenerative changes of the meniscus and then frank tearing of the meniscus. our surgeons are much less inclined to operate on any sort of degenerative tears of the meniscus. Here's now the same thing. Now, again, a linear tear, longitudinal, but now it's horizontal, right? It's going along the plane of the posterior horn towards the anterior horn. So we did a longitudinal vertical, longitudinal horizontal. Again, vast majority of meniscus tears, and you'd be able to describe them with the best radiologists. In terms of abnormal grading and what is abnormal, we wouldn't call signal in the substance of the meniscus other than intersubstance degeneration. The one exception would be in an acute injury. We may describe a contusion of that meniscus, but that's quite rare. To frankly be described as a tear, we need to see the abnormal signal extending to what's called a meniscal surface or an articular surface, as in this case. And if we go back to our vertical, this does extend both to the superior and inferior meniscal surface. I'll tell you, this also extended to that inferior meniscal surface. So in terms of the bucket handle tear, let's go through this and what this would look like. So if we imagine a tear now, and we said that this is the bucket, here's the handle, right? And it's a big piece of this meniscus is now flipped into the notch of the knee. As we image in this plane, again in the sagittal plane, we'll have only two bow ties. And our third one, or if that, we may not even have the second one in this case, right? Because the second one is going through an area of torn meniscus, so we may not see anything. So if we go through a sagittal, you can see that, let's see, I think this is showing basically like an absent bow tie. So where there should be a second image now on the sagittal sequence, we're just getting increased T2 signal or fluid in the joint filling that space. And so this is abnormal. That second bow tie isn't manifesting itself. And we said at least, even in someone with a small meniscus, they should have at least two bow ties. So that would be our first clue. Something's wrong here. And then as we continued on with this patient, we may see something like this. That flipped bucket handle component now is in the notch. What else is in the notch? The PCL. We said the PCL runs just like this. So this black structure, hopefully you'll recognize from earlier, as the posterior cruciate ligament. But we never talked about a second posterior cruciate ligament, right? That shouldn't be there. So what that is now a torn meniscus that's paralleling the course of a PCL called the double PCL sign, which we'll teach our medical students and residents. And this is consistent with a bucket handle tear. If you see nothing else, if there is something that looks like a second PCL, that's a bucket handle tear. And you need to call the surgeon, and that patient will frequently, if not always, go on to surgery. You may also see something like this. I think this is much more subtle, but you can see here, lateral meniscus, that looks good, normal black triangle. Here, doesn't look so good, not a normal black triangle, some signal in it, but we're not done. If we look here, there's also some black low signal that shouldn't be there. Again, this is a cruciate ligament here, this is another cruciate ligament here now in the coronal plane, which we didn't really go through because they're better seen on sagittal, but this structure should not be there. So you can kind of use several different findings to make the diagnosis, but again, I think understanding what it looks like in the transverse plane and then applying it to the different planes is the best way to do so. In terms of what this may look like on an axial, if you're lucky enough to image right through it, you'll see basically what this schematic diagram is showing. A diminutive anterior horn and body and a big bucket handle fragment displaced now into the intercondylar notch that shouldn't be there. This is just to show on consecutive sagittal T2-weighted fluid-sensitive sequences what this may look like. It may even look like something like this with a ghost meniscus, where you're not even seeing a posterior horn now. So much of it's torn that it's all displaced into the notch, and we're not really visualizing much at all. And then you do see the second PCL-type sign consistent now with a bucket handle tear. There are several pitfalls, which I won't get into, but there are other structures that can look like a second PCL that we should be aware of. This is the flap tear. We don't really need to say much more than that. It's an abnormal torn meniscus with a flap being displaced somewhere most often into this area, which is called the gutter. So either a medial gutter of the knee or the lateral gutter of the knee. And these will frequently go on to surgical repair as well. The radial tears we described as being in this plane involving the free edge. Just be aware that that is another type of tear, and it is very often associated with worse progression to a degenerative knee and osteoarthrosis and the need for a total knee arthroplasty. And the reason is because it's torn in this plane, it allows the meniscus to peripherally extrude. So every time you step, the meniscus squeezes peripherally, and the cartilage is now mostly on cartilage. So even though the meniscus is still there, so much of that hoop stress is lost that the cartilage is being lost, and subsequently the bone will get to a point where it's too painful, and the patients will go on to a total knee arthroplasty. In terms of frequency, up to 15% of scoped knees as people age will have a radial degenerative type of a tear. There are other things that we can look for with radial tears, such as this, a cleft, and so on, but I think the main teaching point has been made here, so we'll kind of skip through some of these in the interest of time. One last thing that I wanted to talk about is a meniscal cyst. So if you're looking at an MRI, let's say, and you see something that looks like a cyst in the meniscus or next to the meniscus, that is something that should pique your interest and make you very suspicious of a meniscal tear. We don't normally get cysts in our meniscus or immediately adjacent to our menisci. So when you see that, it's mostly coming from the joint where there's fluid transferring from the joint through the tear now into a perimeniscal cyst. And these can be treated with ultrasound-guided aspirations of the cyst. We'll inject things like anesthetic and steroid to help collapse the cyst. If these recur, then the surgeons will go in and frankly remove the entire cyst as well as the capsule. But ultrasound is an option in this case as well. And moving on to the patellofemoral mechanism and the extensor mechanism, just wanted to show you a couple quick cases of what a quadriceps tendon rupture would look like. Here's a distal quadriceps tendon, normal, black, thin, no abnormality in signal or in continuity. Here, a completely torn quadriceps tendon. And clinically, these aren't a mystery, right? The patient frequently had an acute traumatic episode. Their pain is right in that location. The clinician is very suspicious, and you get the MRI, and you can see the discontinuity there. These are frequently done for pre-surgical planning. Patellar tendon rupture, same thing, right? Frank discontinuity, a lot of adjacent soft tissue edema. In terms of cartilage, just be aware that this is an ongoing area of research that is keenly important because of the underlying bone and the goal of kind of delaying as much as possible the need for a total ankle arthroplasty in someone with advanced degenerative change, so kind of preventative medicine in the case of the cartilage. Certain injuries to the cartilage may manifest like such, where we have an osteochondral lesion. So if you ever hear something like that, it's a deformity or either an injury or a congenital abnormality of both the bone and the cartilage, so an osteochondral lesion. And the surgeons will go back in if these are not yet dislocated, which frequently happens, and they'll tack this back down with some sort of an anchor or something like that to keep this intact and to keep the overlying cartilage intact. You can see that how that would look on an MRI, an abnormal piece of bone with abnormal overlying articular cartilage. And again, you'd want to identify this early so you could go in and stabilize this piece of bone before it displaces. Again, this can be seen congenitally in children in their early teen years, or you'll see it post-traumatically in an adult. This is what we were describing earlier with the plica. So we can have these thickenings of the synovium, which can insinuate into the cartilage. And so this is why the surgeons will on occasion go in and resect these plica, because they can result in full thickness fissures, and this can manifest clinically with anterior knee pain, pain with going up and down steps and things like that, or patellofemoral syndrome. The last thing I just wanted to touch on is we can also look at the bones. We can also see fractures. But again, x-rays are frequently just as good at looking at those structures. And so I didn't want to spend too much time on that. This is just a case in Jerry Rice's case, bringing it back home to San Francisco, what a patellar fracture would look like. And he came back quite quickly after a patellar fracture. Most of these people are out quite a long time, up to 9 months. And you can see here just lucency through that fracture. You can see how subtle perhaps it may be on an MRI, especially in a subacute case, but fairly obvious, again, on an x-ray. And that's why we get x-rays with so many MR images. So going back to our questions, just in summary, our first question, now looking at this MR image of the knee, was, what plane of imaging is shown here? And we talked about sagittal imaging, we talked about coronal imaging, and we talked about axial. Axial was transverse, so we know this is not axial. Coronal was the patient looking directly at us, cutting from superior to inferior. So we know that's not it either. This is a case of a sagittal MRI of the knee. And really one of our workhorses in sports imaging and sports MR. In terms of our second question, some of you may recognize that this is the double PCL sign, so I took this from that section, and so this would be a case of a bucket handle tear. But the question in this case was, what type of MRI is shown here? We know that the fluid in this joint is bright, so we know this is a fluid-sensitive sequence. We said that fluid-sensitive sequences are T2 weighted, whereas fat-sensitive sequences are T1 weighted. And so this is a fluid-sensitive sequence, so we know it's T2. Now we look at the fat is all dark, so we must have suppressed the fat, so this would be a T2 fat-suppressed MR sagittal image. And our last case, if anyone wants to shout out the answer in this case, this is a sagittal fluid-sensitive MRI demonstrating a large knee joint effusion. We're imaging through a ligamentous structure that provides most of the anterior-posterior diameter stability of the knee, and this is a case of shout it out. ACL tear. All right. Thank you guys so much for your attention. I know this is a lot, but the goal was to kind of recreate the experience in medical school. And we do have the privilege of having a second speaker tonight who's going to be Tara Morgan. And so what I've tried to do is show you a lot of kind of the day-to-day bread and butter, people will call it radiology for our musculoskeletal section. One of the most quickly growing and novel techniques that we have in musculoskeletal imaging is musculoskeletal ultrasound. This is not being done everywhere. It was started on the East Coast and at the University of Michigan and has now really become quite prevalent. A lot of research is being done in this field as well. In China, a lot of patients are going on to ultrasound before MRIs, and there is even some talk of having certain criteria by which a patient would first be required to get a shoulder ultrasound before a shoulder MRI for kind of reimbursement purposes and keeping cost of healthcare down. So you may be hearing about that in the next 5 years or so, but just be aware that MSK ultrasound is a growing niche specialty. So without further ado, here's Tara Morgan. Thank you.
So a fun fact as a transition that Dr. Motamedi did not tell you that I'm going to tell you is that both of us have torn our ACL in the past year, so we have a very intimate understanding of the disease process. And I got to say that case three looked sort of familiar to me, so I'm kidding. But I had my MRI here, and after that lecture, all of you would have been able to easily make the diagnosis on my images that I had here. So I'm going to tell you about musculoskeletal ultrasound, and I am one of the faculty here in ultrasound. It's all I do now. It's my favorite area to practice, and we find ourselves saying in this new program on an almost daily basis, how cool is this or how cool is what we're doing, and I want to show you some of the examples of why we feel that way. So the take-home messages from this talk are hopefully you'll be able to answer the question of what is the role of ultrasound in evaluating the musculoskeletal system, and once you see how important and how helpful it can be, you'll say, why isn't everybody doing this? So ultrasound is made up of sound waves, so basically a transducer touches the patient directly. We use some gel as an interface that prevents sound from getting in the way, air from getting in the way of the sound waves. So a benefit is that there's no radiation, and this is good for both the patient and for the person who's doing the operating of the machine. Another huge benefit is that it's a portable technique. So sometimes patients are really sick, they're up in an ICU, and they can't be moved down to the radiology department to get another type of imaging. We're able to take our ultrasound machine to them. It has 3D capabilities, so we can see more than just 2D images. It provides some detail about vascular flow or blood flow. We use different types of transducers. It depends on what we're trying to do and what we're trying to see, but this is what a variety of them look like. So some more pros of ultrasound are that it's fast, it's readily available, and it's really cost-effective, more so than some of the other imaging modalities, and that's another reason why there's a trend of wanting to use ultrasound as a first-line imaging modality for patients rather than some of these more costly measures. It's really good for guidance for procedures. It's easier than some of the other modalities where we have to walk in and out of the room, move the needle, take a picture. We can do it in real time while we're watching what we're doing. And again, there's no radiation to either the patient or the doctor. It's really good for small anatomy. So some of these structures, as you're seeing on the MRI, they're tiny and it's hard to kind of see them in great detail, but we have the benefit of being able to change our field of view such that we can see really tiny structures well with ultrasound. And we use it as both an alternative and an adjunct to MRI. So some examples of this are anytime you have metal hardware, sometimes it either can't get an MRI because there's an incompatibility, or it'll cause an artifact. So that way you can't really see things well around the hardware on an MRI. So ultrasound sometimes can have the power to view those types of cases. And then another scenario where it's helpful is in a pregnant patient, for example. So we can perform MRI in pregnancy, but we try to avoid it, and ultrasound is a great alternative first approach. And this is an example of a pregnant patient we saw in our musculoskeletal clinic. She had pain in her pelvis on the left side, and there's a small muscle back there called the piriformis. So what we did is we imaged it on both the left and the right. This just shows you where the muscle is on the picture. It was larger on the left side where she had pain, so it was suspicious for that being the cause, and we were able to diagnose this without getting an MRI. One of the coolest things I think about using ultrasound for musculoskeletal imaging is the power to use it as dynamic imaging. So what this means is that we're scanning in real time. So usually we're presented with images after they're acquired in the setting of MRI or CT. But we can watch what we're doing as we're doing it and sort of take movie clips, and this can have a real impact. That way we can put our transducer exactly where pain or symptoms are located, and we can then more localize what the pictures are looking like compared to where the symptoms are. And we can move the patient either passively or have them move themselves, whether it's an arm or something else, because some diseases are dependent upon position. So you may not be able to see it when they're resting. For example, a hernia, sometimes someone has to bear down and increase the pressure in their abdomen for a hernia to manifest. And we can put our transducer on the patient while they perform that, and then we can look for those changes. So this is an example of what I'm talking about. So this is someone turning their forearm just like this. This is the distal biceps insertion. So that's a muscle in your forearm, and it attaches on the radius, which is in the forearm at the elbow. And you can just see that this white line is moving with the bone. It just tells us that it's intact, and we're able to see that in real time. This is an abnormal case where someone ruptured their Achilles tendon, the big tendon in the back of the foot and ankle, and we're pushing down along the tendon, and you can see here that these two pieces are moving in opposite directions. If this was a normal tendon, when we moved the foot back and forth, it would all move in the same direction. So using that movement helps us to make the diagnosis. There are a couple of downsides to ultrasound. So we're dependent on these sound waves coming out of the transducer, and then they turn back around and return to the transducer to provide information that makes a picture. So they get absorbed. They're dependent on distance, so it can be difficult to see very deep structures. They also don't like to go through certain tissue types, so air and bone, for example. That's why we use gel as an interface to prevent air. But there are structures that have air in them, such as the stomach, or looking through bones such as the rib cage can be a limitation. It's also not great if you're going to surveil the whole body or a large area, because you do have to use the transducer to look at each spot. And it's operator dependent. It definitely requires skill, which I think is one of the things that once learning ultrasound I found to be rewarding, but it's definitely something that takes some patience and some practice. So we can image in any plane. So unlike just the sagittal and coronal and the axial that we usually look at with our CT and MRI, as we saw in the last lecture, we can turn our transducer any which way. And this is an example of if the person were putting the transducer on someone's abdomen, you get this sort of fan-shaped beam. I think of it like a lightsaber. So you see a lot in one plane, but it's really skinny in the other dimension. So you can turn it any which way, which best sees the pathology. And it's good for organs that don't necessarily kind of go head to toe or left to right. And then this is an example of what you would see if you had to probe in this position. So here we see a little bit of the liver, as in the drawing and on the image. And then this is the aorta, the large artery that runs through the middle of the body we see here on the ultrasound. So we're going to go over the different types of musculoskeletal tissues. I'll show you what they look like on ultrasound, and I'll give you a couple of examples of some abnormalities and when ultrasound can really make the difference in the diagnosis. So we'll talk about soft tissues. So that's the outer part, basically the skin and the fat of the body. Then we'll talk about bone, muscle, and tendons and nerves. So soft tissues is really just the skin and fatty tissue. Usually the next layer deep to that is muscle, when you're talking about the abdominal wall or the extremities. And I like to think of this as the lumps and bumps category. A lot of times that's what we're asked to evaluate. And we may see things ranging from tumors, fluid collections, foreign body, or hernia. So here is a cine or movie clip of an ultrasound, and you can see this little black spot is the abnormality. And we're using a wide field of view here, and this is really helpful because it lets us localize where this is. So we know that the skin is what's closest to and touching the transducer. It's a very thin layer. And then based on the difference in appearance, we can identify the other layers. So this next layer is the fat. Then we have muscle layers of the abdominal wall. And then this is the abdominal cavity. So we can tell using this large field of view that this small nodule is in the fatty layer. And here we're looking at the same exact thing. We've just changed our field of view. Now we're sort of zoomed in, and we can see a lot more detail of what the structure looks like. We can see its borders, but notice that we've lost the ability to really tell exactly where it's located. But the combination of these two pictures gives us a lot of information. This is someone with a sore, swollen forearm, and you can see during this cine clip that we've got some stuff moving around here. If you were thinking this was a fluid collection, you'd be right. This is a very nasty abscess. So we can tell by gently pushing on the skin surface and that this is fluctuant or moving, that this is fluid. And that can give us some information about whether or not we could potentially treat this person with draining this out. The one problem you may have is if the patient's in a lot of pain, they may complain of that during your dynamic evaluation. This is also an abscess, and I like this cine clip because it demonstrates how we're able to determine some vascularity or blood flow to tissue type. So notice how we have all this flashing color surrounding this area. That's because this is infected, and just like when you feel in your skin when something is warm and irritated, this blood flow is coming to try to heal this, and this just gives us more confidence that this is an infected fluid collection. Next, this was a patient who had recent surgery, and again, this was just a swollen area, and this is sort of a jiggle test we're using here, but you can see that whatever's in here is really soft and moving, so this is a post-operative fluid collection. And again, just showing what it's like to look at something in real time. Here we're looking at the abdominal wall. We've got this white line. It looks like it's interrupted here, but really it's when you're looking in real time and have the patient sort of bear down and then relax. You can see this little bit of tissue is sliding in and out, and this is a small hernia that just contains fat in the abdominal wall, and we use this maneuver to make the diagnosis. This is also a hernia. This is containing a small amount of the intestine, and you can see here how the intestine is moving. The muscle in the wall is causing it to contract. So again, this really increases our confidence at what we're looking at. This was a mass we saw along the back of a patient, so this is a common finding that we evaluate, so we can get some information by looking at its size and its shape. But it doesn't have to be fluid to be mobile or to be for having some dynamic imaging be useful, because this is a soft tissue mass, but it's something that's usually pliable or not very hard. So you can see with some gentle pressure that this is manipulatable. And this is a fatty tumor or a lipoma. It's a benign finding that we often see. This is a patient where ultrasound helped triage the care a little bit better. So they stepped on some glass, and they were concerned that there was still some glass within the body. If you look on this x-ray of the foot in the frontal plane, we don't see an abnormality. if you look on the lateral view, you have to look really closely, but down here we see a little tiny speck of something in the skin. If you zoom up on it, this is a piece of retained glass. So we can see it on the x-ray, but it's hard to tell from this two-dimensional image where exactly is it if you were going to cut with a knife to try to take it out and make the smallest cut possible. But what we did in this case was we took our small ultrasound probe, surveilled the area, and then we can see exactly where this piece of glass is located. We can use that to then put a mark so someone knows exactly where to go and take it out, and we can even use measurements to see how far away is it from the skin surface and how large is the structure. So in this case, this was a perfect localization provided by using the targeted ultrasound. So the next tissue type I'm going to talk about is bone. And as you know, bone is a highly calcified, dense structure. So a common misconception is that we can't really see it at all with ultrasound. And in some ways that's true. It appears very bright, and what we really can only see is the surface, because then the sound waves get absorbed and they can't go deep to the bone. But we can see that surface pretty well and get some information from that. And the surface is variable in shape, as you know, as how the skeleton appears, but the general concept is that all bone should have a smooth contour, and when we see that disrupted, you can suspect some sort of underlying abnormality. So here's an example of normal bone. So I'm looking at the heel here. So this is where the Achilles tendon inserts, and you see a bright line, and then it's black behind it, and that's because the sound waves can't get through this bone, but they can show you the outer surface, and we see this nice, smooth, white line. Here's a very different area of the body. We're looking at a joint in the fingers, but similar concept, where you see that even though the bone has sort of a curved shape, the surface is always smooth, and we can see it really nicely, and then we sort of lose the ability to see posteriorly. So bone pathology, we could see, includes fracture, potentially, infection, arthritis, tumors, and hardware abnormalities. And I put a star here because in particular we can see plastic screws, and they use that sometimes in orthopedics. And you can't see these on x-ray, and sometimes they're still difficult to see well on MRI. I have two little plastic screws in my knee from my ACL repair, and you can see them very nicely with ultrasound, and you cannot see them on the x-ray. So here's an example of what a fracture looks like. So in the top picture, you see this very abrupt cutoff, step-off gap in the bone. It's very easy to see that we've lost that smooth contour. So that's what an acute fracture looks like. And then after a few weeks go by and the bone starts to heal, you see this sort of irregular, fluffy appearance. And this is what new healing bone growth looks like. This is very characteristic. So this is a subacute healing fracture. This was a very interesting case we saw here of a young female who had a huge mass in her thigh. We did a biopsy. It was probably the easiest biopsy I've ever had to do because of its size. But if you look here, this is the femur bone that's deep to this huge soft tissue mass. And there's some irregularity, some waviness to the surface of the bone. And as we've shown in the prior examples, that's not normal. We want it to always be smooth. So this is a reaction of the bone to the tumor. And this large tumor actually was originating from the bone. This turned out to be a lymphoma. So next we'll move on to the appearance of muscle with ultrasound. So this is tissue that contracts, so it gets shorter and thickens, and that's how it is able to move the body. The muscle tissue coalesces to form a tendon, and that attaches to the bone, and then the contraction moves the bones. So this is just scrolling through some normal muscle in the calf. So all of this darker tissue is muscle. You get some white lines kind of scattered through. It's a little bit of fatty and fibrous tissue. But this is the normal appearance. This is scrolling down transverse in the calf. So first we see some skin and some fat tissue. And then you can see there's two different muscle layers. You can tell when you're looking at different muscles. The first one is the gastrocnemius. That's those two focal bulges you see in your calf. There's another muscle deep to that. And then we can see the two bones in the calf. So muscle pathology includes tear, hematoma, or a blood collection, again, masses or tumors we can see pretty much anywhere, infection, inflammation, infarction, which is loss of blood supply. Muscle tends to have a specific look when that happens, or atrophy, which is a shrinking of the muscle, and then it tends to be brighter and be fatty replaced. So here's someone who had acute pain and pop in their calf, and it's really easy to see on this still and on this movie clip image that the muscle fibers here look normal and here look normal, but we have this abnormal black area. Black on ultrasound is fluid. There's sort of a bulginess to it, and this was a partial muscle tear focally, and the black around it is likely a small amount of bleeding. Here was a mass that was seen on MRI. We didn't know what its origin was. You can see on this T1 and on this FatSat T2 image. But it's much easier to do guided procedures with ultrasound. And so we saw it very easily here. You can see that it's very round. It's pushing the other structures away from it, so it has some local mass effect. We were able to prove that it had colored Doppler flow, so it was some sort of living tissue. And then at the same time, we were able to use a needle to do a biopsy of this lesion. So we got diagnostic information from this, and this turned out to be a low-grade tumor that needed to be removed. So next, we'll talk about tendons and ligaments. So tendons coalesce from muscle to attach to bone, as shown in this schematic. Ligaments are similar, but they attach bone to bone. So they tend to be a little thinner and a little deeper, but have a similar appearance and a similar mechanism. They have a very characteristic parallel appearance on ultrasound, and you can see that's because of the way that they're arranged. They sort of have almost like a rope or a horsehair type appearance. And these are a very common site of injury and inflammation, and this makes sense because of the way your muscles are contracting to move bones. This area that is inserting tends to get a lot of stress and then can be an area of symptoms. So one of the easiest tendons to see, because it's the largest in the body, is the Achilles tendon. So this is how we would have our ultrasound probe a little higher up on the Achilles tendon, and this is the image that we're going to see. So notice how parallel and perfect this tendon looks. Looks sort of like a horse's tail. It doesn't get focally bigger, and you don't lose any of the signal throughout it. So that's the normal appearance of a tendon. This is looking a little bit further down on the Achilles tendon where it attaches to the bone. So it tends to sort of thin out and have an appearance where it almost looks like it's kind of sticking to the bone, and that's the normal appearance. That's how it's able to move structures when you flex and extend. This is the rotator cuff. We commonly look here for injury, and you can see again how the tendon comes up, thins out, and attaches to the bone in the shoulder. And we could look here for any area that was missing. A black area would be fluid, and that would suggest a tear, or if it was completely torn, the structure would be missing. This is just showing on a cine clip how nicely we can see this with ultrasound. So we don't see any area where this tendon looks like it's missing. It's got this broad base attachment to the bone, and that's the normal appearance. So pathology and a tendon, fancy words they like to use, I feel like, for this, and it gets me confused. But when there's fluid around the tendon in the sheath, it's called tenosynovitis. Tendinosis is the term we use for degeneration or inflammation. I just think of a general irritation of a tendon. And then you can have partial tears or complete tears. This was a patient that we had come in recently who said his right arm hurts. He was a very stoic guy. And looking at him right away, you could see that there was a difference between his left and his right arm. There's a deformity on this side. So in scanning him, we confirmed that he had torn his biceps tendon. So the biceps tendon attaches on the radius here just below the elbow. And you can see in this schematic, this is what we're seeing here. This is the tendon that's been sort of released. And if you think about how you cut anything under tension like a rope, it's going to recoil and then kind of look fatter. So this is that recoiled tendon. And when we scrolled down more inferiorly, we did not see the normal attachment to the radius. This is my favorite tendon case that I love to show, and this was a gentleman where I felt like we really made a quick difference in his care by him coming to see us in ultrasound. So he was about a 40-year-old guy, and he had fallen and broken his wrist about 4 years ago and had it fixed with these plates and screws. He wasn't having any problems till about 6 months prior to seeing us. He fell off of the back of a truck and landed on an outstretched hand. So since then, he was having some difficulty with moving some of his fingers and some pain in his hand. So this x-ray was done, shows this hardware. Nothing is really sticking out. We see the normal appearance of this plate against the bone and a bunch of screws within the bone. We came to us with ultrasound. We noticed something looked funny right away. So you already know now what a bone looks like. So here's the smooth surface of the bone, and we're looking in the wrist. And here's the tendon. There's that horsehair appearance. This is the skin and the fat. And there's something a little extra going on here. If you see, we've got these little bright spots that have this sort of stair-step appearance. And whatever this is way past the margin of the bone. So if you're thinking that this looks sort of like a screw, you're would be perfectly correct. So here's the surface of his bone, and this screw is sticking way out past it and touching the area of this tendon. We turn in the transverse plane, and you don't even have to know too much about ultrasound appearance to look at his right versus his left and see how this tendon is about twice the size. And again, here we see that screw. So this was irritating his tendon, causing tendinosis, and this was the reason that he was having pain. And this was something that they weren't able to see just because of the obliquity and the sort of the smallness of this on the x-ray. Just again showing there was all this vascularity, so extra blood flow to this tendon that was super irritated, again with the screw kind of poking in and causing this inflammation. And so this patient went to surgery almost immediately after this, and they had been in pain and didn't have a diagnosis for 6 months. So it was really a rewarding experience. And the surgeon sent this to us, and she went to the OR within the next week. And here's the screw that had been popping out. So she removed that and repaired his tendon, and he's on the mend. So the last category I want to talk about are nerves. So nerves send electrical signal from the spinal cord. And when we talk about nerves in the musculoskeletal ultrasound sense, we're really looking at these peripheral nerves. So not the brain and the spinal cord, but the nerves that go out to the extremities. They provide both motor and sensation function to our muscles. And we can really only see large nerves. So there's going to be a lot of little tiny perforators, and that's going to be beyond the resolution of really any of our imaging techniques. They have a classic appearance that looks sort of like a honeycomb, and I'll show you what that looks like. And they have some similarities to the tendons, but there's some tricks to tell the difference. So nerves have little nerve fibers that are in a bundle, and then more tissue making those bundles in a bundle, and that's why you end up having this honeycomb appearance. So you can see there's all these little dots, and this is the typical appearance of a nerve in cross-section. This is the median nerve in the wrist, something that's commonly injured or irritated and something that's easy to image because it's very superficial. This is showing the median nerve again in the wrist, and there's a bunch of tendons around it. You can see they look a little tighter packed, and the little dots or the little honeycomb appearance is a little more prominent in the median nerve. This is a sciatic nerve, so we're looking posteriorly just below the gluteal fold. This is a very large nerve. You can see it looks very similar to a tendon, so you have to know your anatomy, and another trick is to follow it proximally and distally and see if it kind of coalesces and becomes a muscle, or does it stay that rope-like appearance, and that's how you can tell the difference between a tendon and a nerve. Another little trick, if you don't know quite what you're looking at, whether something's a tendon or nerve, have somebody move the structure, again, using that dynamic imaging. This is in the wrist, and here you move the finger, and you can see that this is a muscle blending into a tendon. This is moving when you move the finger, and this is the nerve that's below it. It's more of a homogeneous structure that doesn't get wider, and it's not moving with flexion and extension. So nerve pathology that we can see are entrapment. So if something's kind of stuck in a small space, it's going to get swollen, enlarged. You may see color flow or vascularity. They can actually get dislocated. So at your elbow, if you've ever banged the inside of your elbow, that's where your ulnar nerve is. It's sometimes called your funny bone. That nerve can actually pop out of the location that it's in there in that groove and cause symptoms. And you can also get tumors of the nerves. These are usually benign. So a common thing we could potentially look for with ultrasound is carpal tunnel syndrome. So the median nerve, which I've showed you a few pictures of already, passes through the carpal tunnel. It's surrounded by bone and then this sheath of dense tissue. So there's a limited amount of space. And if it gets irritated and inflamed, it's sort of trapped and becomes symptomatic. So what we would see on ultrasound, comparing the normal nerve on the left and this abnormal nerve on the right, is that these tissues, the fibrous tissue that sort of surrounds the nerve bundles, is very thick and much more prominent. So this is inflamed. So in conclusion, musculoskeletal ultrasound has some really unique properties and some advantages that are really helpful in diagnosing patients with certain disease processes. It can be used for both diagnosis and treatment. So we do different types of medication injections or biopsies may help to decide what to do with a patient. And hopefully you're convinced by this talk that it can greatly add to patient care. So thanks for your attention and interest in our new program here, and best of luck with the program. So Dr. Motamidi and I will answer any questions that anybody has.
Ultrasound, is it good for breast tumors?
For breast tumors? Yeah, so mammography is sort of a separate area that I trained in, but I don't currently practice in. But they use the mammogram is like an X-ray, and they use that in combination with ultrasound. Almost all of their biopsy procedures are done with ultrasound. And again, they can really see a small structure sort of blown up in sort of a higher like resolution with ultrasound. So it's a really powerful tool. There are limitations again, like if something is really deep, it's harder to see, but it's complementary with X-rays in the treatment of breast diseases.
So then it would really be able to identify a small lesion in a woman's breast that's growing?
It could. So it's not good for the first thing to do usually, because you have to look everywhere with a little transducer. Usually what's done is a mammogram, because screening sort of looks at the whole area. And then if we see a little tiny abnormality, then we look with our ultrasound in that spot, and we can gain a lot of information, and we could potentially then do a biopsy. Yes. So the question is about whether there's any long-term effects from ultrasound. The answer is almost none. So if you use more of a power setting, there's a theoretical heating of tissue or some damage to tissue. We think about that when we do our pregnant patients, but it's almost never an issue. In adults, it's not something we really think about. So as far as imaging modalities are concerned, when you're talking about radiation, we usually think of it as a safer way to image.
So thank you for that question. The question, again, is the capacity of the MRI scanner in terms of space limitation, as well as the noise level with an MRI machine. So both of those are a little bit beyond my expertise in terms of engineering and MRI techniques and things like that. But I do know from personal experience that MRIs are terribly loud. The standard practice now is to put in earplugs as well as kind of overlying headphones and things like that, and distract the patients as much as possible with movies and things like that. But in terms of why it's so loud, I can't really speak to that specifically. In terms of the enclosure, there is a movement towards developing coils which can be targeted to different joints. So especially for what we do in musculoskeletal imaging, we have a much smaller coil for the wrist, for example, a much smaller coil for the knee, so that only that portion of the body needs to go into the MRI. Because we will have on occasion cases for the spine, because that's such a large field of view, canceled because the patient cannot tolerate or is too claustrophobic. So that is a real consideration for us. And so some of these coils that have been developed are really helping to alleviate that, at least for the skeletal structures like the knee, the ankle, the wrist.
Well, are there bigger? I'm just wondering. Are there bigger size MRI machines?
Yeah.
Really big people?
Yeah, and there are. So I know that for certain patients there is a weight limitation. I think like 300 or 350 pounds. We do have larger bore MRIs in the community, and so we will have the patients be scanned on those images. And there is even something such as a open MRI. But much of the signal-to-noise ratio that we need to interpret these images comes from that enclosure. So when we do open MRIs, the quality of the imaging is much less. So sometimes we don't see some of the fine detail that we would in a closed MRI. But, yeah, great questions.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.